From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Professor Ariane Waite is the director of the Center for Research in Intercollegiate Athletics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
I'm happy to be here. I'm original Oregonian, so I feel like I'm coming back to my roots.
Where did you grow up?
Born in Portland, but then my family lived in Sun River for quite some time.
All right, beautiful, beautiful parts of the state.
Very beautiful, yes.
The world is now a place where college athletes get paid, of course, and there are some people who are wanting to create a major in sports. And I know you've studied that issue, and I'd love if you could just give a brief history of how that came about, and we'll move from there.
Absolutely. Well, I became a professor at UNC Chapel Hill in 2011, and that is now quite some time ago, but in the semester that I began, we were initially investigated by the NCAA, and that semester, in my first couple of weeks, the football coach got fired, the athletic director decided to step down, and shortly thereafter, our chancellor also left, and we were in the national spotlight for an academic athletic scandal relative to primarily athletes taking what they called a paper class, where they would sign up for a class and would have to write a final paper. And the argument was there was a higher level of Greek students and athletes in this class than non-athletes, and the grading was somewhat arbitrary. So that scandal went on for 4 years before it was finally dropped by the NCAA. And as a new faculty member with a background as an athlete, I was really really frustrated by the discussion on campus because I heard individuals talking about sport on one side and athletics on the other as two very different things. And I was an athlete at the University of Utah, and I felt like it was a little bit more integrated in the West, and I actually used that word on purpose. I had an introduction to intercollegiate athletics for athletes where we talked about the papers that we were signing and what it meant to be an athlete and all of the things that we would go through that were unique to our experience. I also got a credit each semester for track and field that I could choose to take if I wanted to. And then I also had probably the most transformational educational experience of my life in a sports psychology class for athletes taught by a renowned professor, where he brought the science of psychology into our lived experience as athletes. And we would share things we were struggling with, and then we would apply the science. And it was unbelievable. Perfect example of experiential education. So I looked at UNC and they were offering none of these things. And I thought, gosh, you know, they had a robust leadership academy where they were essentially, it was a leadership class that they were taking for no credit. They weren't getting credit for their athletics, and all of these things that I thought were normal, given my experience, weren't happening there. So I, you know, looking at the scandal, sure, it's not okay to give credit for things that aren't happening. But on the other end, I thought there are a lot of things that are not getting credit for that they probably should be getting credit for. So that began my decade-long exploration of this topic, and really I've devoted my life to now the study of the intersection of higher education and intercollegiate athletics, and I'm at a point now that I really understand the genesis of how these issues began and hopefully the future of how we can finally integrate athletics and academics. And earlier I mentioned I used that word on purpose in one of the studies that we did. It was evident that in the Southeast, there are far significantly fewer classes for athletes than in the West or Northeast. And so it's actually very much based on, well, a lot of it is the historic racial issues in the South that are continued through credit for athletics, which is really interesting.
There are those who would say, really? Athletes getting credit for being basketball players? Doesn't that seem kind of not okay?
Yes, I've heard that from many, many people. And I think before I dive into that, I want to ask you a question.
Okay, I'm ready.
And I actually just did some research on the University of Oregon, so I've got my facts straight. But can you tell me the difference between an athlete and a musician or a dancer at the University of Oregon?
I have actually been, as I've been thinking about this interview, I've been having this conversation with a couple of people and talking to them. I think it's a cultural difference, is my feeling. My feeling is, oh, well, that's the arts, and those are people who are playing the violin or who are performing on the stage, and we've come to accept that as being an important piece that gives back to the world. Not just as entertainment. This is not necessarily me talking, but this is kind of the view of what I'm gleaning. And that sports is more kind of entertainment. It's not really bringing a whole lot. I'm guessing in a philosophical way, that's where I'm coming down. Economically, I think the difference is clear that athletes at the University of Oregon are highly touted and highly thought of and many times highly paid, and the arts people are not.
So a lot of deep cultural issues and perceptions and economic realities and organizational structure issues in that response. And I love that you've been having this conversation with people. So I asked this question in a faculty executive committee meeting during the scandal, and one of the faculty members that was pretty anti-athletics responded to my question immediately, straight-faced, and he said, "I can have an intelligent conversation with one, and I cannot with the other." And again, given my perception, that was so confusing because I have a lot of experience with incredibly brilliant athletes. And so I realized at that moment, oh, wow, there's a lot of bias and there are a lot of cultural issues underwriting it. So I answered him, and I'll do it in terms of University of Oregon instead of University of North Carolina. An athlete at the University of Oregon can come in and they can earn up to 4 credits in physical education intercollegiate athletics courses. Each course is worth 1 credit, and they can do it up to 4 times for participating in sport. So that's their academic lens. If a person coming in music performance wants to study music, they actually, I'll do dance. There's 42 credits of technique classes, 27 credits of performance classes, 14 credits of creative practice, and 50 credits of theory and seminar. So that in and of itself was what is mind-boggling, right? So even the athletes are limited to 4 credits of practice, and the dancers can get 14 credits in practice, let alone everything else. Another thing is, say, a musician who's passionate about becoming the best musician in the world spends sun up to sundown in the music building, practicing, working with their vocal coach, say, and truly does that all day, every day. We would view them as a dedicated scholar, like a really good student. If an athlete did the same thing, if I wanted to be the best basketball player in the world, and I would come in at 6 a.m., do extra shots, do my strength and conditioning, have practice with my team, do everything, I would be viewed as a dumb jock or a gym rat or the type of student that we would never want to have in our university, even though they're both pursuing their passion. They're both humans wanting to become the best at what they want to do. The only difference is how our universities' credit structures have worked based on what we as a society have historically valued as worthy of academic credit. And that's very, very interesting if you go into the history of what has been viewed as academic and what is not. And it's evolved significantly over the years. And I think we're at a moment now where it's time to evolve and recognize athletics is absolutely worthy of academic credit. And it is now my research unequivocally shows it's actually the best avenue to prepare students for future success. In my research, I've got robust random samples of athletes and non-athletes, and it's not just my research. There are dozens of studies now that confirm this, that athletes in the end have greater satisfaction with life, social support, salaries, job satisfaction, work engagement, health, and health literacy. So you go down the line, and it's all pretty positive.
Let's back up for just a second.
Okay, I know.
And not because there's a lot of places we could go, and I find it really interesting. But let's go back to the place where the musician versus the jock.
Okay.
And we think of music as, oh, they can go on and they can perform, or they also can teach and they can do that for the rest of their life, or maybe they are going to be involved in an art class and they're going to be able to create these amazing things. Athletes' bodies are going to wear out. So what is it that makes it? What are the job skills and the future if we're going to invest in this program and we're going to make it possible for athletes to major in sport? Great. They can play sports for a while, maybe even be professional. What are they going to be able to do besides be a tennis pro?
Well, so I would say the same argument for a musician or a dancer, but actually the comparison to music and dance in my mind is actually very limiting. So it's a good start, and specifically related to that. So the sport performance industry is booming. It is a massive industry. It's actually significantly larger globally than music. By I think a margin of five, or not margin, but by 5 times in terms of its market value. So within that, there's just like a musician can teach, there's strength and conditioning, coaching, sport tech, esports, neuroscience, performance psychology, physical therapy, occupational therapy, psychology, education, leadership. You can go on and on and on, and all of them are very related, but interestingly, I've actually kind of evolved from having this be a major in sport to have it be a major in human performance or performance innovation, because I think the same types of things that, and actually, I think athletics has provided a model for training individuals to perform under pressure, to become leaders, to have dialogue with teammates, and the list goes on. Have resilience after you fail, all of these things that employers need and are looking for. And we need those skills for our future surgeons. We need those skills for all of our students. And so I think by embracing the sport model, we also can kind of change our paradigm a little bit about what this training is and how valuable it is. And interestingly, my music and dance colleagues have been some of the ones that are most excited, because they said, we've been so technical and theoretically based, but we need these other skills too. We need our musicians to be leaders and to work well with each other. And so I think sport is a microcosm of the university. It really touches on every department, and it's so interdisciplinary. And because of that, it offers this ripe opportunity for foundational education in performance science. And you might have an emphasis in sport. You might have an emphasis in pre-med. You might have an emphasis in entrepreneurship. All of those are similar in the fact that they're high pressure jobs where you need to think on your feet and perform under pressure. And the same types of skills that we practice and incorporate into athletics are very generalizable.
Here's another devil's advocate question. A per
Love
oh,
those.
There are students who do work study. They might work in an administrative office. They might work in as an athletic assistant. They might work in the food services industry. A lot, whatever. They're working study to help with their tuition offset. How is that different or the same? And if someone's saying, well, wait a second, the athlete, it's kind of a work study gig, an argument could be made. Why should they be getting paid and I doing this other thing not?
Why should they be getting
Or
paid, or why should they get
why should they be
credit?
getting credit?
Okay. Well, I think that that's a wonderful argument. And I would say that if those work study experiences are directly relevant to the academic pathway of those students, they probably might be getting credit as internships already, if it is a fit, right? But if it's a one-off type of experience, then it probably wouldn't fit relative to academic credit. The other thing is, for it to be worthy of academic credit, you have to have specific learning outcomes and a professor that's overseeing it and a curriculum. And so if those exist in the works of study, I think that that's absolutely worthy of credit if it's leading toward the ultimate goal of preparation for whatever career that they want. And the same can be said for athletics. And there are a lot of athletes that wouldn't want to major in this. But I think that virtually all of them would welcome courses that capitalize on the low-hanging fruit. One of my favorite examples is every athlete spends a lot of time in the weight room and a lot of time conditioning. And I chose to major in exercise and sports science because I wanted to learn what was happening to my body and how it was happening. But if we had an applied exercise physiology class or an applied strength and conditioning type of course where we say these are all of the physiological systems that are in working right now, and this is how you're building your muscle fibers, and this is what it is when you're sore, and so you kind of understand you're doing these things, you're living these experiences. But if you can add the science, again, particularly for Generation Z, which we are embracing right now in our universities, they love technology and they love experiential learning, life relevant things. And I think for any of us, when we learn something in the abstract, it's fine. It probably is stored in there somewhere. But if it's meaningful to the things that we do on a daily basis, it comes alive. It's an educational experience that is unique and exciting and engaging. And that's the opportunity we have here, which I think is very exciting.
Well, I know that there, I read somewhere someone saying, well, a sports major, that seems kind of ridiculous. But I've had some parents who've, I've known some parents whose children have come home and said, I've majored in French literature. And they're looking at them like, what are you going to do with that? So you can, all of these can be used in a variety of ways.
Yeah, well, and so I would hope that those in French literature could justify it.
Really,
One of
I'm not dissing my French literature field.
the no, I'm saying we're at a moment where I think that we in the sport industry need to do a much better job of telling our story. And one of my research projects through a National Science Foundation grant, which has been so unbelievable, is really looking at sport as science. And this summer I had six athletes create videos demonstrating the science that they do in sport. And we're hoping to build this movement on social media with a hashtag sport is science, and having athletes from all over the world show how their sport is science and really telling the story of this is what you see when you're watching football, but this is what we're actually doing. This is the qualitative analysis that we're doing in the film room. This is the psychology that we are continually grappling with. These are the analytics that we use to determine where to go and when to go and how to do it. So, we need to do a better job of telling a story, as does French literature.
You touched earlier in this conversation on racial bias around this conversation. Do you want to delve a little bit into that, kind of elucidate where that's coming from and your studying and your observations about how that works in this discussion?
Sure. Well, gosh, I'm wondering how far to go. There's a little bit of both classism and racism at play. And so classically, if you go back all the way to Plato, there was the discussion in Aristotle. There was the mind-body connection, which was emphasized as important, but there was also a little bit of tension even in the dialogue back then between the athletic brute and the cultivated thinker. Then Descartes in the 17th century talked about mind-body dualism, that they're two separate things. And then, of course, with industrialization, those that used their bodies were typically the working class, and those that used their minds were the aristocracy. And so there's been this divide between the thinker and the doer, and that's been very class and race divided historically. I think when people think of elite athletes, they primarily think of men's basketball and football, and the majority of those athletes are Black. And there is very documented historic bias against the Black male body and what that means and what it has meant in history. And I think that that has played into our maybe how slow we've been to adopt or integrate sport within our institutions when at this point there is no intellectual argument that can stand up to empirical evidence that sport is not an intellectually rich discipline worthy of academic credit.
Are there places where, in fact, an institution has said, it's time. We're creating this major. We're doing it.
Well, many of us have tried and failed and have been seen as crazy heretics along the way. And I think that that has motivated my research significantly. A shift in the tides happened within this year when John Jowers at Nike and a group reached out to a man named David Hollander, who wrote a book, How Basketball Can Save the World. It's a beautiful book about really if we applied the principles of basketball to everyday life, everyone would get along because it provides this training ground for intellectual discourse and civility and so many other things. And the book is beautiful. But Nike really had this mindset that they want to get back to their core of sport, that they're supporting athletes. And David and Nike read my research and approached me, and we kind of came up with this idea of let's make this a movement. Let's get this going. It's time. And so Nike helped kind of grease the wheels at the New York Times, and an article came out in January, kind of broadly exploring the idea. And based on that, a group of faculty that reached out kind of came together, and we've been a support group in many ways, but also we've shared all of our resources. Lou Matz at the University of Pacific, or University of the Pacific, was another early mover who proposed this at his university. I tried several times to propose it at the University of North Carolina. And given the historic backdrop of the academic athletic scandal, I'm really grateful for that because it's probably one of the hardest places to get buy-in given some of the repercussions of that. But between January and now, we have one institution that read the article, mobilized, and proposed it, and now it will be starting in the fall at Southern Virginia University. That's thrilling to all of us that have been in this fight for a while. Others in tow, Boise State has a beautiful model of stackable certificates. So it's a little bit easier to innovate there because it doesn't have to be a whole major that's designed, but you can just really take pockets of classes and then create a certificate program, and then they can get their degree with stackable certificates. The president of American University, Jonathan Alger, is also a very vocal advocate for this, and he's been working with the Knight Commission to get more attention and momentum for the idea. And then Lindsay Wilson is also kind of in process. So we've got five universities that probably will have the major by the end of the year, which is amazing.
And I'm assuming it has to start as kind of an interdisciplinary degree. I mean, it's not like you're necessarily going to open up a degree of a department of sport necessarily, even though there's the athletic department. That's a different issue. But it sounds like this certificate or general kind of cross disciplinary action is the way to go.
I think that the degree components themselves are interdisciplinary. And so, if there are organizational structures that support standing up a degree program in an interdisciplinary way, then that's the way to do it. We'll probably see them pop up in, from sport management programs, and then they kind of expand, or kinesiology programs that then have kind of like we have music theory and music performance. They're very synergistic, but also very different. I can also see them popping up in business schools, focusing more on the leadership, communication, performance under pressure, communication skill type, and even entrepreneurship with NIL. And there's so many options. They theoretically could be in many different departments within universities, but ideally, yes, I would love to see schools of sport. Syracuse actually has a school of sport, and they have sport analytics and sport management and those types of things. So hopefully we'll see more and more of those.
Is there anything else we haven't really kind of touched on here that you think is important as part of the discussion for people to hear, either anecdotally or historically or research?
I think it's important to approach this not as, oh, we're going to give credit for athletes, but rather a broad view of what society values in curriculum. And my hope is that this will trickle down to K through 12. And in saying that, I look at most degree programs at the universities we have, and maybe they require 120 credits. Normally, we're lucky if there's one of those credits devoted to the body, which is wild to me, right? It's this vehicle that houses our brain and everything else. And if it is cracked in any way, everything else goes down. So I would love to see more of an emphasis on the body in our education systems. One of my favorite stories, my nieces and nephew did international school in Asia. And when they came back, I asked them, what was the most difficult course or experience that you had? And all of them said PE. And I was so confused. And they said there were specific time trials in every sport. So for swimming, for instance, they hadn't had the background in swimming that their classmates had had. And so if they were 20 seconds slower on the swim test, they had to wear a heart rate monitor and get their heart rate up for so many hours based on how slow they were in the swim test, because physical education is valued significantly more than it is in the United States. And then you look at our healthcare costs in some of the Asian countries versus here, and you're like, well, okay, that seems to be a correlation between what they value in education and then our health outcomes. So when we look at the evolution of education, back in the day in the 17th and 18th centuries, the main goal of liberal arts was discipline in the study of abstract subjects like Greek grammar and mathematics and Latin that really had no play in their everyday lives. And little by little, we've evolved to be a little bit more experiential and a little bit more life-centric for our education. And you look at all of these different disciplines. Back in the day, we didn't accept history, government, and economics as worthy of academic credit. In the 19th century, music and dance were purely extracurricular. So there's been a history of evolution, and I think it's really valuable to think if our curriculum are evidence of what we value as a society. What do we value, and why do we have those values? And is it time to update the things that we spend, that our children spend thousands of hours studying? Could we use that time in a different way?
What inspires you to continue this fight?
I think there's a lot of stubbornness because I've been told so many times that I'm crazy and that it's not something that is positive. And so for every door that's slammed in my face, I've gone and tried to find data, because you can't argue with data. And I also credit that to, of course, my parents, but also my sport experiences. When I failed in track and field, I got right back up. And I am a heptathlete. My daughter's a heptathlete, and you have seven events. You finish one, you move right on to the next one. And whether you do great or poorly, it doesn't really matter, because you're moving on. So I think it's part of my personality. And I also think that it's so impactful when I look at, actually, when I talk to our college students, I've asked so many of them, I say, do you see yourself as a scientist or a scholar? And a lot of them are like, maybe a scholar, but no, definitely not a scientist. And I'm like, well, how do you see yourself? Like, they're like, well, I'm a student and I'm an athlete. Primarily, I see myself as an athlete. Like, that's how I define myself. And then I share Howard's theory of multiple intelligences, which is absolutely brilliant, and it's changed the way that I look at intelligence, and I think that everybody should. Our education systems historically have valued logical, mathematical reasoning and linguistic. It's math and language. But Howard defined all these different types of intelligences, and people can be brilliant in any one of them. And one of those intelligences is bodily kinesthetic movement, also interpersonal and intrapersonal spatial recognition. Like, all of these different modes of intelligence, when I explain them to them, I'm like, you're actually a genius. Like, and also, all these things that you do in sport, that is science in action. You're hypothesis testing on every single play, and kind of just giving them the language and the perspective that no, you're not a dumb jock. You are absolutely brilliant. The intelligence that you've emphasized just hasn't been recognized within our education systems yet. But I hope that it will, because as soon as you see yourself differently, as soon as you see yourself as a scientist or an academic or any one of these things, it opens up a whole new world of jobs and possibilities with the self-confidence and self-efficacy that you develop. So this grant I'm doing with a team from University of Maryland, we're trying to facilitate a pipeline from sport to data science, because sport is such a data-rich environment, and there's so much opportunity to really dive into that. And I don't think we've historically capitalized on that opportunity. So I suppose that's a bit of my motivation. I think it can change the world, just like David Hollander's book mentions. I do. I think sport, and especially team sports, where you navigate rules and you're on the same level with everyone you play, it's just the most wonderful laboratory for learning.
Thank you. We could go farther, and I really appreciate the piece of enlightenment that you've brought to the subject. Dr. Arianne Waite of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and I look forward to hearing more and seeing where it goes.
Thank you. I'm excited.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.